No sound came out. The mouth of the intruder did open. Dennis saw huge white teeth. And then a big warm tongue was lapping his face.
Ugh,
Dennis said, trying to push the thing away. Paws came up on either shoulder, and Dennis fell back on his mattress of napkins like a pinned wrestler. Lap, lap, lick, lick.
Ugh,
Dennis said again. And the dark, shaggy shape uttered a low, companionable woof, as if to say, I know it. I'm glad to see you, too.
Frisky!
A low voice called from the darkness.
Stand down, Frisky. No sounds.
The dark shape was not Flag at all. It was an extremely large dog. A dog which looked too much like a wolf for comfort, Dennis thought. When the girl spoke, it drew away and sat down. It looked happily at Dennis. Its tail thumped mutedly on Dennis's bed of napkins. Two more shapes in the darkness, one taller than the other. Not Flag, that much was clear. Castle guards, then. Dennis grabbed his dagger. If the gods were good, he might be able to get rid of both of them. If not, then he would try to die well in the service of his king. The two figures had stopped a little short of him. Come on, Dennis said, and raised his dagger. It was really not much more than a pocket knife, and was rather rusty and quite dull. In a brave gesture. First you two, and then your devil dog.
Dennis?
The voice was eerily familiar.
Dennis, have we really found you?
Dennis started to lower his dagger, then brought it up again.
It had to be a trick, had to be.
But the voice sounded so much like...
Ben?
He whispered.
Is it Ben Stodd?
It's Ben, the taller shape confirmed, and gladness filled Dennis's heart. The shape began to come forward. Alarmed, Dennis raised his dagger again.
Wait, do you have a light?
Flint and steel, yes.
Strike it.
Aye. A moment later, a big yellow spark, surely dangerous in that room filled with dry cotton napkins, flared in the gloom.
Come forward, Ben,
Dennis said, receding his poor excuse for a dagger in its sheath. He got to his feet, trembling with gladness and relief. Ben was here. By what magic, Dennis did not know, only that it had somehow happened. His feet caught in the napkins and he stumbled forward, but there was no danger that he might fall, because Ben's arms swept him up in a strong embrace. Ben was here, and all would be well, Dennis thought, and it was all he could do to keep from bursting into unmanly tears. 107. There followed a great exchange of stories. I think you have heard most of them, and the parts you haven't can be told quickly enough. Frisky's leap was a bullseye. She carried straight into the pipe and then turned around to see if Naomi and Ben would follow her. If they hadn't done so, Frisky would have eventually leaped back to the ice. She would have been greatly disappointed to do it, but she would not have left her mistress for the most exciting scent in the world. Frisky knew that. Naomi was less sure. She didn't even dare call Frisky back for fear of a guard's overhearing. She therefore intended to go after the dog. She would not leave Frisky, and if Ben tried to make her, she would deck him with a right hook. She needn't have worried. The minute he spotted the pipe, Ben understood where Dennis had gone.
Noble nose, Frisky, he said again.
He turned to Naomi.
Can you make it? If I draw back and run, I can make it.
Don't misjudge where the ice goes rotten, or you'll take a dunking, and your heavy clothes will drag you down very quickly.
I won't misjudge.
Let me go first, Ben said. If I have to, maybe I can catch you. He drew back a few paces and jumped so strongly that he almost took off the top of his head on the upper curve of the pipe. Frisky barked once, excitedly.
Shut up, dog, Ben said.
Naomi drew back to the edge of the moat, stood there for a moment. The snow had by then been coming down so heavily that Ben couldn't see her, and then ran forward. Ben held his breath, hoping she wouldn't misjudge the edge of the good ice. If she ran too far before trying to make her leap, the longest arms in the world wouldn't catch her. But she timed it perfectly. Ben didn't need to catch her. All he had to do was to get out of her way as she carried into the pipe.
She didn't even bump her head, as Ben had done.
The worst part of it was the smell, Naomi said as they told their story to a wondering Dennis. How did you stand it?
Well, I just kept reminding myself of what would happen to me if I got caught, Dennis said. Every time I did that, the air seemed to smell a little better.
Ben laughed at this and nodded, and Dennis looked at him with shining eyes for a moment. Then he looked back at Naomi.
It did smell awfully bad, though, he agreed. I remember that it smelled bad when I was a kid, but not that bad. Maybe a kid doesn't really know how bad a smell is, or something.
I guess that could be, Naomi said.
Frisky was lying on a pile of royal napkins with her muzzle on her paws, her eyes moving from one person to the next as each spoke. She knew very little of what they were saying, but if she had, and if she could have spoken, she would have told Dennis that his perceptions of what made a really bad smell hadn't changed at all since he was a boy. It had been the last dying reminder of the dragon sand they had smelled, of course. The odor had been much stronger to Frisky than to the girl and the tall boy. Dennis's scent had still been there, now mostly in splashes and blobs on the curved walls. These were the places Dennis had touched with his hands. The floor of the pipes was covered with a foul, warm water that had washed away all scent. It was the same bright electric blue. The other scent was a dull, leathery green. Frisky was afraid of it. She knew that some scents could kill, and she knew that not so long ago, this had been just such a scent. But it was losing its potency now, and in any case, Dennis's scent led away from the greater concentrations of it. Not too long before they reached the grating Dennis had used to get out of the sewer system, she began to lose the green smell altogether, and Frisky was never in her whole life so happy to lose a smell.
You met no one? No one at all? Dennis asked anxiously.
No one, Ben said. I ranged a little bit ahead to keep an eye out. I saw guards several times, but we always had plenty of time to get to some cover before they could see us. In truth, I think we could have come directly here and passed 20 guards and only have been challenged once or twice. Most of them were drunk.
Naomi nodded.
Guards of the watch, she said. Drunk. And not drunk out on picket along the northern borders of some pissy little barony no one ever heard of. Drunk in the castle. Right in the castle. Dennis, remembering the toneless, nose-blowing singer, nodded gloomily. I suppose we should be glad. If the guard of the watch was now what it was in Roland's day, we'd all be in the needle along with Peter. But I can't be glad somehow.
I'll tell you this, Ben said in a soft voice. If I were Thomas, I'd quake in my boots every time I looked north. If such as we saw tonight are all as he has around him.
Naomi looked very troubled at this.
Pray the gods it never comes to that, she said.
Ben nodded. Dennis reached out and stroked Frisky's head.
Followed me all the way from Paina's, did you? What a smart dog you are.
Aye.
Frisky thumped her tail happily. Naomi said, I would hear this story of the sleepwalking king, Dennis, if you would tell it again.
So Dennis told his story, much as he told it to Paina, and as I have told it to you, and they listened as spellbound as children hearing the tale of the talking wolf in the Gammer's nightcap. 108. By the time he had finished, it was 7 o'clock. Outside, a dim gray glow had come over Delane. That clotted stormlight was as bright at 7 as it would be at noon. For the greatest storm of that winter, and perhaps the greatest in history, had come to Delane. The wind howled around the eaves of the castle like a tribe of banshees. Even down here, the fugitives could hear it. Frisky raised her head and whined uneasily.
What do we do now? Dennis asked.
Ben, who had gone over Peter's brief note again and again, said, Until tonight, nothing. The castle's awake by now, and there's no way we could get out of here without being seen under any circumstances. We sleep, get our strength back. And tonight, before midnight...
Ben spoke briefly. Naomi grinned.
Dennis's eyes grew bright with excitement.
Yes, Dennis said. By the gods, you're a genius, Ben.
Please, I wouldn't go that far, Naomi said. But by then her grin was so broad it seemed in danger of splitting her head in two. She reached over, put her arms around Ben, and kissed him soundly. Ben turned an absolute alarming shade of red. He looked as if he might be on the verge of bursting his brains, as they said in Delane in those long-ago days. I must tell you, though, that he also looked delighted.
Will Frisky help us?
Ben asked when he got his breath back. At the sound of her name, Frisky looked up again.
Of course she will. But we'll need...
They discussed this new plan for some time longer, and then Ben's lower face seemed to almost disappear in a great yawn. Naomi also looked tired out. They had been awake for over 24 hours by then, you will remember, and had come a great distance. Enough, Ben said. It's time for sleep.
Hooray,
Naomi said, beginning to arrange more napkins and a mattress for herself beside Frisky.
My legs feel as if...
Dennis cleared his throat politely.
What is it?
Ben asked. Dennis looked at their packs. Ben's big one, Naomi's slightly smaller one.
I don't suppose you've got, anything to eat in there, do you?
Impatiently, Naomi said,
Of course we do. What do you think?
Then she remembered that Dennis had left Paina's farmhouse 6 days ago, and that the butler had been skulking and hiding ever since. He had a pallid, undernourished look, and his face was too narrow and too bony.
Oh, Dennis, I'm sorry. We're idiots. When did you eat last?
Dennis thought about this.
I can't remember exactly, he said.
But the last sit-down meal I had was my lunch a week ago.
Why didn't you say so first thing, you dolt?
Ben exclaimed.
I guess because I was so excited to see you, Dennis said and grinned.
As he watched the two of them open their packs and begin rooting through the remainder of their supplies, his stomach gurgled noisily. Saliva squirted into his mouth. Then a thought struck him.
You didn't bring any turnips, did you?
Naomi turned to look at him, puzzled.
Turnips? I don't have any. Do you, Ben?
No. A gentle and supremely happy smile spread across Dennis's face.
Good, he said.
109. That was a mighty storm indeed, and it's still told of and delaying today. 5 feet of new snow had fallen by the time an early howling dark came down on the castle keep. 5 feet of new snow in one day is mighty enough, but the wind made drifts that were much, much bigger. By the time dark fell, the wind was no longer blowing a force gale. It was blowing a hurricane. In places along the castle walls, snow was piled 25 feet deep and covered the windows of not just first and second floors, but the third floor windows as well. You might think this would have been good for Peter's escape plans, and it might have been if the needle hadn't stood all alone in the plaza, but it did, and here the wind blew its hardest. A strong man couldn't have stood against that wind. He would have been set rolling head over heels until he crashed against the first stone wall on the far side of the plaza. And the wind had another effect as well. It was like a giant broom. As fast as the snow fell, the wind blew it out of the plaza. By dark, there were huge drifts piled against the castle and clogging most of the alleys on the west side of the castle keep. But the plaza itself was clean as a whistle. There were only the frozen cobbles, waiting to break Peter's bones if his rope should break. And I must tell you now that Peter's rope was bound to break. When he tested it, it had held his weight. But there was one fact about that mystic thing called breaking strain that Peter didn't know. Yosef hadn't known either. The ox drivers knew it, though. And if Peter had asked them, they would have told him an old axiom, one known to sailors, loggers, seamstresses, and anyone else who works with thread or rope. The longer the cord, the sooner the break. Peter's short test rope had held him. The rope to which he meant to entrust his life, the very thin rope, was about 265 feet long.
It was bound to break, I tell you, and the cobbles below waited to catch him, and break his bones, and bleed away his life. 110. There were many disasters and near disasters on that long stormy day, just as there were many acts of heroism, some successful and some doomed to failure. Some farmhouses in the inner baronies blew over, as the houses of the indolent pigs were blown over by the wolf's hungry breath in the old story. Some of those who were thus rendered homeless managed to work their way across the white waste to the castle keep, roped together for safety. Others wandered off the Delane Great Road and into the whiteness, where they were lost. Their frozen, wolf-gnawed bodies wouldn't be found until the spring. But by 7 that evening, the snow had finally begun to abate a little, and the wind to fall. The excitement was ending, and the castle went to bed early. There was little else to do. Fires were banked, children tucked in, last cups of field tea drunk, prayers said. One by one, the lights went out. The crier called in his loudest voice, but the wind still tore his voice out of his mouth at 8 of the clock and again at 9. It was not until 10 that he could be heard again, and by then most people were asleep. Thomas was also asleep, but his sleep was not easy. There was no Dennis to stay with him and comfort him this night. Dennis was still home ill. Thomas had thought several times of sending a page to check on him, or even to go himself. He liked Dennis very much. But something always seemed to come up. Papers to sign, petitions to hear, and, of course, bottles of wine to be drunk. Thomas hoped Flagg would come and give him a powder to help him sleep. But ever since Flagg's useless trip to the north, the magician had been strange and distant. It was as if Flagg knew there was something wrong, but could not quite tell what it was. Thomas hoped the magician would come, but hadn't dared to summon him. As always, the shrieking wind reminded Thomas of the night his father died, and he feared he would have a hard time getting to sleep, and that once he was asleep, horrible nightmares might come, dreams in which his father would scream and rant and finally burst into flames. So Thomas did what he had grown accustomed to doing. He spent the day with a glass of wine always in his hand, and if I told you how many bottles of wine this mere boy consumed before he finally went to bed at 10 of the clock, you probably wouldn't believe me, so I won't say. But it was a lot. Lying there miserably on his sofa, wishing that Dennis was in his accustomed place on the hearth, Thomas thought, "My head aches, and my stomach feels sick. Is being king worth all this? I wonder." You might wonder, too. But before Thomas himself could wonder any more, he fell heavily asleep. He slept for almost an hour, and then he rose and walked. Out the door he went, and down the halls, ghostly in his long white nightshirt. This night a late-going maid with an armload of sheets saw him, and he looked so much like old King Roland that the maid dropped her sheets and fled, screaming. Thomas's darkly dreaming mind heard her screams and thought they were his father's. He walked on, turning into the less used corridor. He paused halfway down and pushed the secret stone. He went into the passageway, closed the door behind him, and walked to the end of the corridor. He pushed aside the panels which were behind Niner's glass eyes, and though he was still asleep, he pushed his face up to the holes, as if looking into his dead father's sitting room. And here we will leave the unfortunate boy for a while, with the smell of wine surrounding him and tears of regret running down his sleeping eyes and down his cheeks. He was sometimes a cruel boy, often a sad boy, this pretend king, and he had almost always been a weak boy. But even now I must tell you that I do not believe he was ever really a bad boy. If you hate him because of the things he did, and the things he allowed to be done, I will understand. But if you do not pity him a little as well, I will be surprised. 111. At 11:15 on that momentous night, the storm breathed its last gasp. A tremendous cold gust of wind swept down on the castle. It ran in excess of 100 miles an hour. It tore the thinning clouds overhead apart like the swipe of a great hand. Cold, watery moonlight shone through. In the third eastern alley was a squat stone tower called the Church of the Great Gods. It had stood there since time out of mind. Many people worshipped there, but it was empty now. A good thing, too. The tower was not very tall, nowhere near the height of the Needle, but it nevertheless stood high above the neighboring buildings in the third eastern alley, and all day long it had been punished by the unbroken force of the storm wind. This final gust was too much for it. The top 30 feet, all stone, simply blew off, as a hat might fly off a scarecrow in a high gale. Part landed in the alley, part hit the neighboring buildings. There was a tremendous crash. Most of the populace of the castle keep, wearied by the excitement of the storm and already sleeping deeply, took no mind of the fall of the Church of the Great Gods, although they would wonder greatly over the snow-covered wreckage in the morning. Most simply muttered, turned over, and went back to sleep. Some guards of the watch, those not too drunk to care, heard it, of course, and ran to see what had happened. Other than by these few, the fall of the tower went mostly unremarked when it happened. But there were a few others who heard it, and by now you know them all. Ben, Dennis, and Naomi, who were getting ready for their attempt to rescue the rightful king, heard it in the napkin storeroom and looked around at each other with wide eyes. "Never mind," Ben said after a moment. "I don't know what it was, but it doesn't matter. Let's get on with it." Beeson and the lesser warders, all of them drunk, didn't hear the Church of the Great Gods fall down, but Peter did. He was sitting on the floor of his bedroom, carefully pulling his woven rope through his fingers, looking anxiously for weak points. He raised his head at the snow-muted thunder of falling stones and went rapidly to the window. He could see nothing. Whatever had fallen was on the Needle's far side. After several considering moments, he went back to his rope. Midnight was close now, and he had come to much the same conclusion as his friend Ben. It didn't matter. The dice had been thrown. Now he must go on. Deep in the darkness of the secret passage, Thomas heard the muffled thunder thud of the falling tower and woke up. He heard the muffled barking of dogs below him and realized in horror where he was. And one other, who had been sleeping lightly and dreaming troubled dreams, awoke at the fall of the tower. He woke even though he was deep in the bowels of the castle.
"Disaster!" one of the parrot's two heads screamed. "Fire, flood, and escape!" the other screamed.
Flag had awakened. I have told you that evil is sometimes strangely blind, and so it is. Sometimes evil is lulled with no reason, and sleeps. But now Flag had awakened. 112. Flag had come back from his trip into the north with a bit of a fever, a heavy cold, and a troubled mind. "Something wrong, something wrong." The very stones of the castle seemed to whisper it to him. But Flag was damned if he knew what it was. All he knew for sure was that unknown something wrong had sharp teeth, and felt like a ferret running around in his brain, taking a bite here and a bite there. He knew exactly when that animal had begun to run and gnaw. While he was coming back from the fruitless expedition in search of the rebels, because the rebels should have been there. They hadn't been, and Flag hated to be fooled. Worse, he hated feeling that he might have made a mistake. If he had made a mistake about where the rebels were to be found, then perhaps he had made mistakes about other things. What other things? He didn't know. But his dreams were bad. That small, bad-tempered animal ran around in his head, worrying him, insisting that he had forgotten things, that other things were going on behind his back. It raced, it gnawed, it ruined his sleep. Flag had medicines that would rid him of his cold, but none that would touch that growing ferret in his brain. What could possibly be wrong? He asked himself this question over and over again, and in truth it seemed, on the surface at least, that nothing could be. For many centuries the old dark chaos inside him had hated the love and light and order of Delane, and he had worked hard to destroy all that, to knock it down, as that last cold gust of storm had knocked down the Church of the Great Gods. Always something had interfered with his plans. A Kyla the Good, a Sasha, someone, something. But now he saw no possible interference, no matter where he looked. Thomas was totally his creature. If Flag told him to step off the highest parapet of the castle, the fool would want to know only at which o'clock he should do it. The farmers were groaning under the weight of the killing taxes Flag had persuaded Thomas to impose. Yosef had told Peter there was a breaking strain on people as well as on ropes and chains, and so there is. The farmers and the merchants of Delane had nearly reached theirs. The rope by which the great blocks of taxes are attached to any citizenry is simple loyalty. Loyalty to king, to country, to government. Flag knew that if he made the tax blocks big enough, all the ropes would snap, and the stupid oxen, for that was really how he saw the people of Delane, would stampede, knocking down everything in their path. The first of the oxen had already broken free and had gathered in the north. They called themselves exiles now, but Flag knew they would call themselves rebels soon enough. Pena had been driven away, and Peter was locked in the needle. So what could be wrong? Nothing. Damn it, nothing. But the ferret ran and squirmed and gnawed and twisted. Many times over the last 3 or 4 weeks he had awakened in a cold sweat, not because of his recurring fever, but because he had had some horrible dream. What was the substance of this dream? He could never remember. He only knew that he woke from it with his left hand pressed to his left eye, as if he had been wounded there, and that eye would burn, although he could find nothing wrong with it. 113. On this night, Flag awoke with his dream fresh in his mind, because he was awakened before it was over. It was, of course, the fall of the Church of the Great Gods which woke him. "Huh!" Flag cried, sitting bolt upright in his chair. His eyes were wide and staring, his white cheeks damp and shiny with sweat. "Disaster!" one of the parrot's heads screamed. "Fire, flood, and escape!" the other screamed. Escape, Flag thought. Yes, that's what's been on my mind all this time. That's what's been gnawing at me. He looked down at his hands and saw that they were trembling. This infuriated him, and he sprang out of his chair. "He means to escape," he muttered, running his hands through his hair. "He means to try, anyway. But how? How? What's his plan? Who helped him? They'll pay with their heads, I promise that. And they won't come off all in a chop, no. They'll come off an inch, a half inch, a quarter inch at a time. They'll be driven insane with the agony long before they die." "Insane!" one of the parrot's heads shrieked. "Agony!" the other shrieked back. "Will you shut up and let me think?" Flag howled. He seized a jar filled with murky brown fluid from a nearby table and threw it at the parrot's cage. It struck and shattered. There was a flash of bright, heatless light. The parrot's two heads squawked in terror. It fell off its perch and lay stunned at the bottom of its cage until morning. Flag began to pace rapidly back and forth. His teeth were bared. His hands worked together restlessly, the fingers of one warring with the fingers of the other. His boots struck up greenish sparks from the nitre-caked stones of his laboratory floor. These sparks smelled like summer lightning. How? When? Who helped? He could not remember. Already the dream was fading, but... "I have to know," he whispered. "I have to know." Because it would be soon, he sensed that much. It would be very, very soon. He found his key ring and opened the bottom drawer of his desk. He took out a box made of finely carved ironwood, opened it, and drew out a leather bag. He opened the bag's drawstring top and carefully took out a chunk of rock that seemed to glow with its own inner light. This rock was as milky as an old man's blind eye. It looked like a piece of soapstone, but was in fact a crystal. Flag's magic crystal. He circled his room, turning down the lamps and capping the candles. Soon his apartment was in absolute darkness. Dark or not, Flag returned to his desk with quick confidence, passing easily around objects that you or I would have barked our shins on or fallen over. The dark was nothing to the king's magician. He liked the dark, and he could see in it like a cat. He sat down and touched the stone. He slipped his palms down its sides, feeling its ragged edges and angles. "Show me," he murmured. "This is my command." At first, nothing. Then, little by little, the crystal began to glow from within. There was only a tiny light at first, diffuse and pallid. Flag touched the crystal again, this time with the tips of his fingers. It had grown warm. "Show me Peter. This is my command. Show me the whelp that dares put himself in my way, and show me what he plans to do." The light grew brighter, brighter, brighter. Eyes glittering, cruel thin lips parted to show his teeth. Flag bent over his crystal. Now Peter, Ben, Dennis, and Naomi would have recognized their dream, and they would have recognized the glow which lit the magician's face, the glow which was not a candle. The crystal's milky cast suddenly disappeared, drawing into the brightening glow. Now Flag could see into its heart. His eyes widened, then narrowed in bewilderment. It was Sasha, very pregnant, sitting at a little boy's bed. The little boy was holding a slate. On it were written two words, God and dog. Impatiently, Flag passed his hand over the crystal, which now gave off waves of heat. "Show me what I need to know. This is my command." The crystal cleared again. It was Peter, playing with his dead mother's dollhouse, pretending the house and the family inside were being attacked by Indians, or dragons, or some foolish thing. The old king stood in the corner watching his son, wanting to join in. "Bah!" Flag cried, waving his hands over the crystal again. "Why do you show me these old, meaningless stories? I need to know how he plans to escape, and when. Now show me. This is my command." The crystal had grown hotter and hotter. If he did not allow it to go dark soon, it would split apart forever, Flag knew, and magic crystals were not easy to come by. It had taken 30 years of searching to find this one. But he would see it broken into a billion pieces before he gave up. "This is my command," he repeated again, and for the third time the milkiness of the crystal drew inward. Flag bent over it until its heat made his eyes water and gush tears. He slitted them, and then, in spite of the heat, they flew open wide in shock and fury. It was Peter. Peter was slowly descending the side of the needle. Surely this was some treacherous magic, because although he was making hand-over-hand motions, there was no rope to be seen. Or was there? Flag waved a hand in front of his face, dissipating the heat for a moment. A rope? Not exactly. But there was something. Something as gossamer as a strand of spider web, and yet it bore his weight. "Peter!" Flag breathed, and at the sound of his voice, the tiny figure looked around. Flag blew on the crystal, and its bright, wavering light went out. He saw its afterglow in front of his eyes as he sat in the dark. Peter, escaping. When? It had been night in the crystal, and Flagg had seen errant, gritty sheaves of snow blowing past the tiny figure working its way down the rounded wall. Was it to be later tonight? Tomorrow night? Sometime next week? Or... Flagg pushed back from his desk and stood up with a lurch. His eyes filled with fire as he looked around his dark and stinking basement rooms. Or had it happened already? Enough, he breathed. By all the gods that ever were and ever will be, this is enough. He strode across the darkened room and seized a huge weapon that hung on the wall. It was clumsy, but he held it with ease and familiarity. Familiar with it? Yes, of course he was. He had swung it many times when he had lived here and done business as Bill Hench, the most feared executioner Delane had ever known. This terrible blade had bitten through hundreds of necks. Above the blades, which were of twice-forged Anduin steel, was Flagg's own modification, a spiked iron ball. Each spike had been tipped with poison. Enough! Flagg screamed again in a fury of rage and frustration and fear. The two-headed parrot, even in the depths of its unconsciousness, moaned at that sound. Flagg pulled his cloak from the hook by the door, swept it over his shoulders, and fastened the clasp, a hammered silver scarab beetle, at his throat. It was enough. This time his plans would not be thwarted, certainly not by one hateful boy. Roland was dead, Pena unbenched, the nobles driven into exile. There was no one to raise an outcry over one dead prince, especially one who had murdered his own father. If you have not escaped, my fine prince, you never will. And something tells me you're still in the coop. But part of you will leave tonight. I promise you that. That part I intend to carry out by the hair. As he strode down the corridor toward the dungeon gate, Flagg began to laugh, a sound which would have given a stone statue bad dreams. 114. Flagg's intuition was right. Peter had finished going over his rope of twisted linen fibers, but he was still in his tower room, awaiting the crier's announcement of midnight, when Flagg burst out of the dungeon gate and began to cross the Plaza of the Needle. The Church of the Great Gods had fallen at 11:15. It was 11:45 when the crystal showed Flagg what he wanted to know, and perhaps you'll agree with my idea that it tried to show him the truth in two other ways at first. And when Flagg started across the plaza, it was still lacking 10 minutes of midnight. The dungeon gate was on the northeast side of the Needle. On the southwest side was a little castle entrance known as the Peddler's Gate. A straight diagonal line could have been drawn between the dungeon gate and the Peddler's Gate. At the exact midpoint of that line was the Needle itself, of course. At almost the same time that Flagg came out of the dungeon gate, Ben, Naomi, Dennis, and Frisky came out of the Peddler's Gate. They approached each other without knowing it. The Needle was between them, but the wind had dropped, and Ben's party should have heard the clang rasp of Flagg's boot heels against the cobbles. Flagg should have heard the faint squeak of an ungreased wheel. But all of them, including Frisky, who was back to her old job of pulling again, were lost in their own thoughts. Ben and his party reached the Needle first. "Now," Ben began, and at that moment from the other side, less than 40 paces around the outside perimeter from where they now stood, Flagg began to hammer on the triple-bolted warder's door. "Open!" Flagg screamed. "Open in the name of the king!"
"What?"
Dennis began, and then Naomi clamped a hand like steel over his mouth and looked at Ben with frightened eyes. 115. The voice came spiraling up to Peter on the cold, post-storm air. It was faint, that voice, but perfectly clear. "Open in the name of the king." "Open in the name of hell, you mean," Peter thought. The good, brave boy had become a good, brave man, but when he heard that hoarse voice and remembered that narrow white face and those reddish eyes, always shadowed by the hood of his robe, Peter's bones turned to ice and his stomach to fire. His mouth was as dry as a wood chip. His tongue stuck to the roof of his mouth. His hair stood on end. If someone has ever told you that being good and being brave means you will never be afraid, what that someone told you is not so. At that moment, Peter had never been so afraid in his whole life.
It's Flag, and he's come for me.
Peter got up, and for a moment he thought he was going to simply fall over as his legs buckled under him. Doom was down there, hammering at the warder's door to be let in.
Open up! On your feet, you licey drunken buggers! Beeson, you son of a sot!
Don't hurry, Peter told himself. If you hurry, you'll make a mistake and do his work for him. No one's come to let him in yet. Beeson's drunk. He was tiddly at supper and probably paralyzed by the time he got to bed. Flag hasn't a key or he wouldn't be wasting time knocking. So, one step at a time, just as you planned it. He's got to get in and then climb those stairs, all 300 of them. You may beat him yet. He went into his bedroom and pulled out the rough iron cotter pins that held the crude bed frame together. The bed collapsed. Peter grabbed one of the iron sidebars and carried it back into the sitting room. He had measured this bar carefully and knew it was wider than his window, and while its outer surface was rusted, he thought it was strong yet through the middle. It had better be, he thought. It would be a bitter joke indeed if my rope held but my anchor broke. He looked out briefly. He could see no one now, but he had observed three figures crossing the plaza toward the needle shortly before Flag's wild pounding had begun. Dennis had recruited friends then. Had one of them been Ben? Peter hoped so, but did not dare to really believe it. Who was the third? And why the wagon? They were questions he had no time for now.
Oh, you dogs! Open this door! Open it in the king's name. Open it in the name of Flag. Open the door. Open.
In the stillness of almost midnight, Peter heard the rattled thud of the wrist-thick iron bolts far below being drawn back. He supposed the door opened, but he didn't hear that. Silence. And then a gurgling, choked scream. 116. The unfortunate lesser warder who finally answered Flag's summons lived less than 4 seconds after drawing the third bolt on the warder's door. He caught a nightmare glimpse of a white face, glaring red eyes, and a black cloak that blew backward in the dying breeze like the wings of a raven. He screamed. Then the air was filled with a dry whooshing sound. The lesser warder, who was still half drunk, looked up just as Flag's battle axe split his head in two.
Next time someone knocks in the name of the king, bestir yourselves, and you won't have a mess to clean up in the morning, Flag bellowed.
Then, laughing wildly, he kicked aside the body and strode up the corridor toward the stairs. Things were still all right. He had awakened to the danger in time. He knew it. He felt it. He opened a door on the right and stepped into the main corridor, leading away from the courtroom where Anders Pena had once dispensed justice. At the end of that corridor, the stairs began. He looked up, grinning his dreadful, shark-like grin.